when I actually even learned what gastroenterology was, when my mom was diagnosed with colon cancer. This is when I was a senior in high school. She ended up passing away less than a year later. And I just remember she'd asked, do I need to get a colonoscopy? And no, only men get colon cancer.
You've got to be kidding me.
No.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of IndoCast. I'm your host, Leslie Bishop, and this is episode 24. With our physician guest, Dr. Anjuli Luthra from the Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida. IndoCast is a GI-focused podcast for clinicians, by clinicians, presented to you by Boston Scientific. Together, we'll take a closer look at the data, techniques, and insights of endoscopy that matter most to listeners like you. Dr. Luthra, welcome to IndoCast. I'm super excited to have you.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, so I'm excited to talk about all the clinical stuff, but before we get into that, I'd love to hear about your background. How did you get into medicine? How did you get into GI and then therapeutic GI?
Absolutely. So I don't remember exactly what it was that I wanted to go into medicine. I was pretty young in high school. I was very lucky that I had a lot of exposure to science. I think probably a big majority of us that go into medicine, we have a combination of liking science and helping people and being around people. And then when I actually even learned what gastroenterology was when my mom was diagnosed with colon cancer. This is when I was a senior in high school. She ended up passing away less than a year later. And I just remember, you know, thank God we at least had Google at that time. That's when I was looking up, what do you do for colon cancer? And first thing I remember reading was gastroenterologist help diagnose that. Now you have to remember, this was at a time before, you know, Katie Couric and some other celebrities really made a push to discuss colon cancer and colonoscopies. And actually, there was still quite a bit of gap of insurance coverage. And that's, you know, when my mom was diagnosed. And fortunately, I think there was still a lot of inherent bias in the medical community. My mother was very educated as an attorney, and I remember her talking after her physical and when she turned 50, and she'd asked, do I need to get a colonoscopy? And no, only men get colon cancer.
You've got to be kidding me.
No. Not that I think it would change outcome. I mean, it was unfortunately metastatic at time of diagnosis, but it really shows what a knowledge gap there was in our medical community. And shortly thereafter is when Katie Couric's husband died from that, and she really made a push to not only help ensure insurance coverage for that on most things, although I know we're still fighting some gap battles on that, but to really educate the public, this is not a gender-specific disease, and in fact, we're seeing it in younger and younger patients. So that's why they've recently lowered the age of screening colonoscopy to 45, even if you have no risk factors. So all that to say, that really set me on my trajectory to GI, and then I had some really wonderful mentors during my medical school and residency that exposed me to advanced endoscopy, and I was just hooked. I think I was only in a third year medical student when I realized, yep, this is what I wanted to. So it just is really, you get so lucky. And I think that's why it's so important to have mentors that end up exposing you to certain things you otherwise may not know of and find what your passion is.
So you knew you wanted to be a doctor in high school. Mm-hmm. And then you knew GI doctor in high school even.
Yes.
Because of this illness with your mom.
Yes. Yes.
That's an unbelievable story. And then you knew advanced GI. Was it the procedures? What was it about advanced GI you liked so much?
Yeah, I liked the complexity, and especially being just a medical student where one, you're just enamored with everything about medicine that you're learning, and then you're seeing not only these amazing procedures, these endoscopy procedures that have not just diagnostic but therapeutic potential, and then you're seeing, oh, they're accessing the bile duct, they're getting endoscopic ultrasound views of the pancreas and structures. I just found it absolutely fascinating. And that passion never wavered, clearly, as I continued on that.
Okay, so talk to me more specifically. What's your focus of your practice now?
So I recently just made a pivot to more academic position, and my personal passion is pancreas cysts. Again, this is thanks to mentorship, where I did my fellowship training and was exposed to, you know, a world expert on novel diagnostics in pancreas cysts, and learning that, you know, these can result in up to 20% of pancreas cancers. And certainly with my familial history, anything we can do to prevent any type of cancer, just I really am passionate about. Beyond that, I really love that I can offer therapeutics to patients, that I can, particularly at a cancer center, play a huge role in confirming or ruling out malignancy, guiding their treatment, helping take away some of their anxiety. my personal passion is, you know, very complex hilar strictures with ERCP, pancreas cysts, doing confocal to microscopy and other novel diagnostics, and the research related to those.
Let's talk about ERCP. I'd love to hear how you've seen it change over the last maybe decade, especially with single-use imaging.
Yes. I still remember when I was rotating, I was a resident this time with the GI fellows on consults, and I think this must have been right when Spyglass was being utilized. I had no idea what the heck Spyglass was, but I just remember all the fellows were getting so excited because there was a patient that needed it, and so I got to go see this procedure, and lo and behold, they're getting direct visualization of the biliary tract.
Okay, so let's talk about your Spyglass algorithm. Maybe you can do stricture management and stone management. I'd love to hear about both of those.
Yeah, I think with stones, it might be a little more straightforward. I think sometimes there may still be hesitancy to go straight to incorporating Spyglass for EHL of large stones, but what I found is, you know, if you already are seeing on, we're getting cross-sectional imaging on all these patients, which is appropriately so before you're going to do an invasive procedure such as ERCP, and you're seeing these sometimes massive stones, the chances that you're going to be successful in getting a stone that large just with a sphincterotomy and papillary balloon dilation and either balloon or basket extraction is going to be pretty low, along with potentially increasing risk of post-sphincterotomy bleeding or pancreatitis, but particularly in our young female patients. So that was a practice I started to take on more, was if I already know this is going to be a large stone, 1 centimeter plus, I start talking to the patient and consent them for the possibility, the high possibility of proceeding with Spyglass with electrohydraulic lithotripsy.
Okay, and then what about stricture management?
So with strictures, I think this is where Spyglass has really been immensely helpful clinically. Sometimes you can have the clinical situation that can guide you what the cause of their stricture is. For example, patient that's had cholelithiasis or gallstones, they've had their gallbladder out, now they're coming in with a biliary stricture, that could be just benign. And certainly if it doesn't progress over a 6-month period, that helps point to that. But there are so many cases where you have these indeterminate strictures. Typically, if I'm seeing them, usually they've already had maybe an ERCP where they've done brushings, which are good, but the sensitivities are still pretty low. More and more, I think, using Spyglass early to visualize, because what I'm finding is you see a stricture and then you may see other abnormalities throughout the biliary tract, and this can allow you to not only locate that better, delineate what abnormalities you see, and then also take biopsies, not just from the stricture you may see on your fluoroscopy.
And then what's your approach and technique for taking those direct visualized biopsies?
I actually had a really good case not too long ago. This was a person that actually had this intraductal biliary mass on imaging. And one could say, well, you could just biopsy the area or plan to just focus on that area with Spyglass, particularly because it was distal. And then you may run into this issue with distal strictures as well, where your stability with the Spyglass probe is not going to be great. My goal is to always get the Spyglass at least up to the bifurcation so that I can slowly start to withdraw. And I think that's where you could also get a chance to see, oh, there's this mucosa lining also does not look nice. Uh-huh. I don't like this. Let's take a biopsy here. And particularly in that case, again, not a stricture exactly, but just talking about abnormalities in the biliary tract, she didn't just have a mass in the area we saw in cross-sectional imaging. There were other abnormalities in the proximal duct and the intrahepatics, and we were able to make targeted biopsies of those sites and separate them by jars so we can actually tease out what process is going on.
And how many biopsies are you taking?
That depends. I'm very aggressive and very extensive, and part of that is, you know, I think many of us in GI hate to get the pathology readback of, you know, inadequate tissue or, you know, kind of an inconclusive read, so I always want to get as much tissue as possible, especially when you're using SpyBite Max. It's going to be teeny tiny dots of tissue. So I will really, and I recommend to anyone who may not be doing this, it's tedious, it takes a lot of time in your case, going in and out with the SpyBite Max with the Spyglass, but to really make sure you're getting at least 4 to 5 good pieces that you can actually try and visualize, even though they are extremely minuscule, to increase the chances of knowing that you're going to get adequate tissue and can help this patient get an accurate diagnosis.
Okay, so because we're dealing with such tiny little biopsies, what are your best suggestions for the preparation of that biopsy?
The nice thing is it's pretty similar to what we do with our regular biopsy forceps. You know, the nurses will open, shake it into the formalin jar, but then they also may use a little angiocath or a little sterile kind of Q-tip to help scrape off. Because again, these are very tiny forceps. They're very tiny pieces, and so it may not always come off when you're just opening it into your specimen jar. So it's really imperative that your nurse or tech who's actually taking the biopsies is really inspecting the open spy bite after hoping that it's been put into the formalin jar and just really making sure we didn't miss a piece. They're also checking the jar before we go back down. Did I get a piece? Is it in there? And so communication between your team, just like with anything else in our procedures, is so important. Unlike the through-the-needle biopsy forceps, you don't have to worry about microfilters that pathologists use for specimens. They're not quite on that small of a level. But I think like with any new technology, if there is some practices where the pathologists are not as familiar with this, it's always important, I think, to meet with that department separately, kind of talk about, help them be aware of what this actually entails, what we're looking to do, if their process needs to change at all, and work in congruence to make sure that we can get that taken appropriately.
So what do you see as the main benefits of using SPY for both the hospital and the patient?
Oh gosh, I think if you think about it, I mean, my God, for such a long time, trying to even see what the heck is going on in the bile duct, even just on cross-sectional imaging, and then with just standard ERCP. And you may have patients that undergo multiple procedures, multiple ERCPs with brushings or biopsies. I briefly alluded to this before, but it allows targeted biopsies. So I think we get better use of the procedure, so to speak, of not just taking biopsies randomly throughout, but you're able to actually see this looks abnormal. Let's make sure we focus on getting biopsies of that. I know some places have actually started using spyglass almost in like a mapping type pattern for your biliary tract if they have diagnosed either gallbladder of the cancer or cholangiocarcinoma of one spot. And there's actually been some few cases where you're, even though it looked normal, we're finding some traces of malignant cells. And so I just think it's utilization is going to continue to grow. I think there may be some more studies and hopefully guidelines to coming down the road in the next few years to further guide that. But I just think for patient care and helping to get a diagnosis, and think about all the anxiety we would have as a patient where you're being told, well, there's something abnormal. Of course, worst case, it could be cancer. And then you can't get an answer and you keep having procedures. The hope is, you know, many times spyglass and being able to directly visualize your biliary tract and directly target biopsies can hopefully get to an answer sooner. In my experience, I think many of my colleagues, many patients, not that they enjoy getting a bad diagnosis, but at least it's a lot of them express some reduction in their stress and anxiety because now they know at least what the heck is going on and what do we need to do next. And I think that helps empower them too.
Oh, I totally get that. That unknown, yeah. That anxiety, yes. Of then it's just worry. At least then you have a plan and you
exactly.
Can move forward with something.
Exactly right.
Okay, so I'd love to hear what is emerging in ERCP that you're excited about.
Oh gosh, there's so many things. And I get really excited about innovations because I think, you know, when we, there's just so much on the forefront. I think it's a really exciting time to be a gastroenterologist. I know sometimes people may say EUS and interventional EUS is the way of the future, and that's not wrong, but I also think there's a lot of great advances in the ERCP world. I mean, one, we've been talking about the improved imaging technology of spyglass, the utilization of AI, which we're seeing is across all spectrums of the GI and the clinical world. I really think, you know, what came out of a negative in terms of multi-drug resistant infections from the reusable duodenoscopes has birthed a really phenomenal ability to innovate ERCP scopes. So when we're looking at single-use duodenoscopes, and I know some of this may still be controversial, but I personally also see a really positive side where it's taking us away from this is the type of scope we've had, this is how it's always been, this is how it is, to okay, if we need a single-use device to cut down our MDR infections, what else can we do to innovate this? How can we make this better? How can we make this not only improve from an ergonomics position, but for the procedure itself, make access easier, make intubating into the pylorus or really challenging GI anatomies easier. Especially as a woman in advanced endoscopy, I mean, these dials are typically a little bit larger for our smaller hands. The scopes may sit a little heavier because we typically often have different structure than our male counterparts. And so I think that's also exciting to have those type of changes to single-use scopes or even potentially down the road, reusable duodenoscopes scopes that can help fix that issue as well. Because again, the rate of injury, especially in advanced endoscopy, can be higher than other proceduralists just because of the type of maneuvers and the procedures we're doing.
Oh, that's really interesting. This has been amazing. I've loved this conversation. I was going to turn it to you to see if you had any final thoughts on ERCP, Spyglass, anything you want to talk about.
I just think it's relatively widespread. I think it's been so easily incorporated because there was such a need for it. And I think it's become part of every gastroenterologist and therapeutic endoscopist toolbox. I think it's only going to continue to improve as the technology improves, particularly from visualization, not just from biliary strictures of indeterminate etiology or intraductal masses or lesions, but from stone management. I think one thing to think about, particularly that I find interesting, is a lot of our gastric bypass patients no longer get their gallbladder taken out because it's not being covered. And so you can still see these patients developing these large stones that then may pass into the bile duct. And so, having that Spyglass with your AHL, especially if it's already going to be challenging to get into there, whether you're doing an edge procedure, meaning you're accessing the remnant stomach in a Roux-en-Y with EUS, or you're doing a lap-assisted ERCP, you're trying to coordinate with the surgeons, you're in the OR, it's not necessarily anyone's favorite thing. And so if you have to do it repeatedly, it's a little cumbersome, whereas if you have a plan for that and utilizing Spyglass with EHL, I think, many times you can take care of the patient, get it done, and get them going.
Yeah, boom, done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, well, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode of Endocast. Please subscribe to the podcast and follow Boston Scientific Endoscopy on our Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn feeds. You can also visit our virtual education platform, EduCare. That's educare.bostonscientific.com, and choose gastroenterology. The site features over 180 resources, including physician-led educational videos, lectures, case studies, device training videos, procedural tips, and techniques. Thanks for listening. Endocast listeners, an important disclaimer. These materials are intended to describe common clinical considerations and procedural steps for the use of reference technologies, but may not be appropriate for every case or patient. Decisions surrounding patient care depend on the physician's professional judgment in consideration of all available information for the individual case. Boston Scientific does not promote or encourage the use of its devices outside of their approved labeling. Case studies are not necessarily representative of clinical outcomes in all cases, as individual results may vary. Thank you.